Here's the other issue. When we're talking about encryption, what's being encrypted? The transmission. Over the airwaves is encrypted. If I physically break in to a remote station and I plug directly into your hub, that's not encrypted. The local transmission data is not encrypted. Also, what if I go in, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and I break open your device and I start going in and putting sensors on the chip or the bus? That's not encrypted. So there are easy ways to bypass, even if there is encryption done at the transmission level. If you get down to the LAN, local area network level, or the chip, most of that is completely open, plain text communication that somebody can intercept, read, or gather the information. Also, if we go back to our rule that availability and integrity are the big goals there, you can encrypt all you want. What happens if I go in and I set off explosives on your RTUs? What if I go in and do a wireless denial of service attack so nothing gets communicated? Yeah, that encryption's not going to help you there. That's not going to help you from a denial of service attack. Encryption's only going to help you from availability. So if the goal is to go in and take down communication and not make it available, if you're talking about microwave and infrared, both of those require line of sight. So if I can just go in and interfere with the line of sight communication, I can knock that down. Also, satellite can be interfered with. If any of you go in and use satellite communication, heavy weather conditions can cause issues and problems with the satellite communication. And it's always funny to watch because we have DirecTV in our house where it's actually a satellite dish for the television. And when we get some really bad storms in Northern Virginia and we lose the satellite for 2 to 3 hours, oh, it's the funniest thing to watch. It's like we are torturing our children. Daddy, how can we survive for 3 hours without a TV? I'm like, why don't we play a board game? It's like I'm speaking a foreign language. It's scary how much these kids are reliant on technology, internet, and TVs. If you take away their screens, they don't know how to handle it. Now, of course, being a dad that works in technology, I would be lying if I didn't hack their systems periodically, but let's not go there on that front. But there is line of sight requirements there also. So doing denial of service attacks can also be pretty easy to do. Then if you go in and look at your 802.11, what frequencies do most of your wireless run as? Typically 5 gig. Go and look at what frequencies do baby monitors, cordless phones, microwave ovens run on? Typically 5 gigs. So you can go in and you can take pretty much commercial available devices and create pretty good jammers to go in and take down the wireless communication. My favorite is there's baby monitors called Tech Baby. They actually have very, very strong transmitters in them. If you take two of them and you put a piece of tin foil between them and you duct tape them together and you turn them on, they interfere and create an awesome jammer. I get within 50 meters of any wireless and it will completely take down the entire wireless communication. And the Tech Baby monitors are about $80 each, tin foils, a few bucks, some duct tape you can just steal from Tim in the back, and we'll be good to go. So for a few hundred bucks, you can have a really nice jammer that can go in and take down and cause issues. Then, because we're dealing with a hub and we're dealing with interception, we can always do what we call a person-in-the-middle attack. This is where you sit in the middle of the transmission, and you can do passive. What is a passive person in the middle of attack called? Just sniffing. So you're just sniffing the traffic. But you can also do active person in the middle attack. This is where you're actively intercepting and then altering the information that's going back and forth between the two respective parties. And ultimately, what we're trying to do from either an availability, take down the communication, or integrity is spoof, modify or change those control signals. If I can go in and send false sensor readings to the HMI, we can go in and be able to cause weird things to occur or happen within the environment. We at conferences often have many instructors that we teach together. And we add me and another instructor, Mike, that I do a lot of work with. And we often share rooms which are on the same HVAC unit. And I guess Mike was getting mad at me one time because I was keeping the rooms too cold. So what he did is he found where the sensor reading was and he took a cigarette lighter and he put it underneath that sensor reading and pretty much went in and turned our room into the Arctic zone because he spoofed it to think it was really, really hot. So it went into overdrive and turned our room to about 5 degrees below zero. And then he walks in going, is it cold enough for you? Right. That's an example of spoofing the control to give it false information to misread the operations of the system. So depending on what type of attack you're trying to do, you can go in and spoof those signal controls. That's in essence what Stuxnet did. When Stuxnet broke in, what was it doing? It was giving false sensor reading to cause the centrifuge to operate incorrectly, to cause inadvertent behavior to occur at that utility plant. So that's ultimately what the attack vector was to spoof or alter those controls. So what we'd like to do is go in and show you how you could potentially sniff and intercept Modbus communication and be able to alter or change that behavior within the environment. So if we're going to go in to page 48 in your system, and what we're going to do is we're going to go in and start up a program called Modbus Pal. This is a free tool that will let you simulate how a Modbus controller is going to be operating and working within your environment. So that's what I have over here. And we're going to have you go in and we're going to have you set up a voltage regulator. And we're going to set up two values for that voltage regulator. We're then going to have you set up an input voltage where you're going to go in and generate some random values there. And then you're going to hit run to get everything going. And then we're going to go in and have this simulate your Modbus communication. And then we're going to go over to a terminal screen, which is right here. And you're going to run a tool, MPT-get, where you're going to start off by going in and reading information from the Modbus. And then we're going to have you alter and write information to the Modbus. So we're showing you that if you can get on that local LAN communication, you could be able to intercept, modify, or change the behavior of that Modbus communication. Now, one important note for this lab. Make sure you go very slow. The notes give you the explicit steps that you need to perform, and the slides give you the screenshots for what you're doing. If you follow every step, it works very well, and you can be able to set up the Modbus simulator and be able to read and write the information. However, if you're skimming and you miss one sentence or one step, it's not going to work. So it's important. I know it's getting a little later in the day, and you might be a little tired, but I just really want you to urge you to go very, very slow with this lab. Read everything very, very closely and follow every step, and then everything will work. We would be more than happy to help you. We understand everyone works differently, so if you're having trouble and you want us to help us, we will. But typically, when we have students in other classes that are having trouble with this lab, it's because they didn't go and read everything in the notes. They just skimmed, and they ended up missing key steps. So this is one of these labs you really want to start on page 50. Read everything very closely, follow the steps, and then look at the slides to be able to determine what actions to take. And of course, as always, if you have any trouble, problems, or issues, just go ahead. And if you want to get confused more, just call me over. And if you want the problem solved, just ask for Graham or Tim, and they can help you out there. So all three of us will be walking around helping you with that. It is 4 o'clock. I want to make sure you have enough time to go through this, play around, and really get familiar with it. So I'm going to go in and give you 25 minutes for this lab. I don't want you to rush this or feel rushed at all. So we'll give you 25 minutes and we'll start back up at 4:25. We then have about 20 slides and then we have one more lab that we're going to have you go through. So like I said, we're tracking very, very nicely in terms of time, but we want to make sure you can really get into the labs because that's really the hands-on learning. So 25 minutes. And we'll start back up at 4:25, and we'll walk around. And as always, any questions or comments, just let us know. Okay, so before we move off of this lab, I just want to put in a little context of what you just did and how you would use this in an operational environment. This simulation tool is not just for a lab. You would use the simulation tool to be able to do system acceptance testing, to be able to generate traffic that would occur from a field device, to be able to go in and inspect and see how it works in an operational environment. So you might not always be able to get the actual field device within a lab to do the full testing. So what can you do? You can take this tool and you can create the same exact input-output, and methods that are produced by it, you can then be able to analyze and verify that everything's working correctly and use that to be able to test the device before it's ever put into production without actually having to deploy the real device within that lab environment. So I just wanted to make it clear that this tool was not just something we use in class to be able to have random data appearing. It can also be used as a simulation and testing tool to be able to verify how the device would work within an operational environment. So it has many, many uses just outside of what we did within the classroom. So now that we had a chance to see how we can test, validate, and simulate our components, the next area we'll look at from an attack perspective is something called fuzzing. Fuzzing is a generic term in which you're going to go in and you're going to test the ability of a system to handle large amounts of different type of traffic. So when we fuzz an application, if I'm fuzzing an input field, what am I going to do? I'm going to start sending large amounts of data to it to see how it would handle it. What is the reason why I would fuzz an input field of an application? To test for an overflow condition. That's how we find buffer overflows. The idea of a buffer overflow is you're creating a variable for an input, and if you're not doing explicit error checking, I could write more than I allocated. So if I go in and I send 50,000 characters to every input field, if there's valid error checking, I would get to the limit and it wouldn't work. If there wasn't error checking, most variables are not going to be 50,000 characters. So now if there's not error checking and I send 50,000 characters, what am I going to do? I'm going to be overwriting random areas of memory. And what's your program going to do? Weird stuff. So if all of a sudden I start fuzzing input fields and your application starts crashing, behaving in an adverse manner or acting strange, I now know I have an overflow condition. I can then go in and walk the stack, find out where the overflow occurs, figure out the memory address of the variable, and write my own custom zero-day exploit to overflow your system. We can also use fuzzing as a way to see when a denial of service attack can occur within your environment. So I can fuzz your network to see where performance limitations are going to happen and occur. So as we mentioned, we can use fuzzing for overflows. We can use fuzzing as a method of SQL injection. If you go back to our SQL injection lab that we did earlier today, what was the first thing I had you do? Put in a single quote and hit enter to see how the system responds. That in the essence was fuzzing. You were doing a generic fuzz to see how it would respond and whether it did error checking. If your system was protected and you did a single quote, what would happen? The error checking would throw it out and you wouldn't get any message back. But when you fuzzed that single quote, what happened? You got an error message that showed you the select from the user database, and you got the command dump, which showed you that there's an exposure. And then we systematically walked you through how to develop a very basic exploit to do injection attacks against that specific database on that specific system. So we were going through these methods as part of the lab to show you how that process works and operates. When we talk about wireless attacks, there's essentially the three vectors: disclosure, alteration, and destruction, which tie directly against the tenets of confidentiality, integrity, and availability. We talked about how encryption of the payload can help with the disclosure aspect, but it's not necessarily going to help with the availability, and it might not help with the integrity component of it. So because our wireless is a hubbed environment, we can sniff and analyze all that traffic. We can always do a resource exhaustion attack against any signal communication. We could also go in and spoof source IP addresses. And because most protocols aren't authenticating, we can use that to send false or inaccurate sensor data back to the system. If you're going to be going in and doing any sort of denial of service, you would need to be able to figure out what the frequency ranges are for the specific bandwidth carriers of the different communication. And then you would just be able to create a device that would jam or spoof those respective signals. Now, we need to put a big caveat here. Technically, doing a denial of service attack against wireless communication is not hard. You can buy equipment for $50 to $75 that you can program in the frequency range and you can jam like a pro. However, the caveat is, in many countries, wireless signal is regulated by the government. And if you go in and you start transmitting unregistered signals, you could be violating many laws and potentially have criminal charges brought against you. So just be careful with this section. While technically it's an easy thing to do, it's a very illegal thing to do in many, many countries, because you have to be careful of that signal because you have to register it. Otherwise, you can interfere with other legitimate communication that is out there. So when we're doing a wireless denial of service attack, we're typically going in and we're creating a device that interferes with the normal radio signals or frequencies that's communicated by the device, so it can no longer be received by the AP. Now, when we talk about wireless denial of service, you really have two targets. If you look at wireless, you essentially have a device and you have a receiver known as an access point. I could go in and I could take down the access point with a denial of service, and then all devices will no longer be able to communicate with that access point. But depending on what my goals are and how the system is set up, I might be able to strategically do a denial of service attack just against one of the endpoints. So I might want to go in and take one field device offline, but have all the other field devices communicating. So this way I can hijack, take over, or spoof signals. So in that case, I wouldn't want to go against the AP. Because if I go against the access point, all the devices are offline. I would want to do a strategic attack just against that specific device. So there's actually two vectors that we can go in and utilize to be able to launch these style of attacks against our target system. Then when we go in and talk about the attack vectors, you have different signals that you're going to go in and deal with. You have your basic AM and your FM, which you can see as slightly different modulation waves of how that works and operates. The good news for you, most of this you don't have to get into, because the products or services that you would use or the products or services that the adversary would use, this is all built in already. You can buy pretty high-end commercial state jammers that would work very, very well for going against this. So most adversaries are not going to be sitting there writing assembly language and going in and creating their own denial of service attack. They're literally going to use these third-party products that are out there for testing or validation services. Then once we go in and we figure out the modulation, the radio frequency that's being used, literally, I could just spoof or simulate any signaling at that point. Once again, there are tools out there that the adversary would use to be able to go in and do these style of attacks. The hardware for doing capturing, $20-$30. The hardware for doing transmission, $300-$400. Once again, not talking terribly, terribly expensive here. So it's a fairly low-cost way to be able to buy equipment that can transmit, spoof, or do these style of attacks to be able to alter, modify, or take down the communication. So now that we've gone in and we've looked at some of the wireless attacks, how we would go against some of the communication protocols that are in place within our environment, we're now going to go in and finish up our last section of the day with one final lab where we're going to look at attack on remote devices. So we're going to go in and look at a little bit of the physical attacks, some of the technical interfaces, physically going after the chips and the bus on the actual embedded electronics, because a lot of these terminal units out in the field sometimes are just sitting in a basic box with a little lock. A lot of this stuff, it's not very hard to physically get access, open up the back of the box, and be able to directly connect to the actual chips or the communication bus to be able to intercept or pull out information or data. When we do authorized pen tests, this is typically the way that we would exploit or break crypto, is I would usually just go to one of the field devices, break it open, go in and put up two diodes, sniff off the keys, brute force the key, and then go in and use that cryptographic key to read and analyze all the encryption traffic going back and forth in the environment. It's an area that many organizations don't think of because it sounds really difficult. Oh, someone's going to break open the equipment. Not that hard and much simpler and easier than trying to intercept keys in the communication protocols. So if you can get physical access to the device, you can always go in and steal it, modify it, embed malware in at a hardware level, or get direct access to sniff information off the system. In many cases, these remote locations are protected with fences, which can easily be climbed or cut with basic clippers. Most of the locks are fairly easy to defeat. Most locks are meant to keep honest people out. If you've ever taken any lock picking courses or you understand the electronics of any of these lock systems, they are not terribly difficult to bypass or get around if you know how they work, operate, and function. So locks are basically meant to keep honest people from going into an area. They're pretty easy to break or defeat. And if you're not into high tech, in most cases, if you take a fairly large screwdriver, you push it through the lock, and you take a sledgehammer and slam the back of the screwdriver, it will pop most locks relatively easily in those environments. Finally, most of these locks today are not key locks, because for field technicians, you don't want them to have to carry around hundreds of keys. They're usually four code spin locks, so this way you can have the same code on all of those. And believe it or not, I will go in and bet you a large amount of money that in most of those facilities, it will be one of 10 things. 1, 2, 3, 4, or 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 2, 2, 3, 3, 3, 3, 4, 4, 4, 4, 5, 5. In most cases, it's a fairly simple, easy one to remember. And I'm not kidding you. I would always say that at the larger SANS conferences, they use those exact same locks to lock down their equipment. so somebody can't steal them during lunch or during breaks. And one of the AV guys were in there, and I went through those, and he goes, "Why did you tell everyone the combination to our locks?" I'm like, okay, you need to change that now, right? So it's usually something easy to remember. So most of the time when we go up there, I usually leave the sledgehammer in the truck because 5 or 10 guesses, we usually have that thing open pretty quickly. And then once you break one, you pretty much have access to all of them. Also, video cameras. More and more of those video cameras are IP enabled wireless video cameras. So what do? A denial of service attack against those cameras. And once again, they go down pretty darn quick. Also, once again, just showing you from an adversary perspective, what's another very, very effective measure that we see utilized a lot for bypassing or getting around field cameras? Paintball guns. You go in and hit a camera lens with a paintball, and it's pretty much going to go and cover it with paint. And typically, it's water is dissolving, so after rainstorm or anything else, it will recover back to a normal state. But most of the time, if you go in and hit a camera lens with a paintball, it won't damage the camera, but it will blind it for about 4 to 5 hours. So if somebody needs to get in and get out, nothing like a quick little paintball gun. Spray paint works, but that tends to have more damaging effects on there, but easy ways to bypass and get around those cameras. And then any alerts that are raised, if you do set off the alarm, are going to once again take a response time. But most of these alarms are all sensor based. So once again, if you take a piece of metal and you slide it in before you open it, you can keep contact, tape it, or once again, not getting too basic, but nothing a piece of chewing gum can't handle either, where you put a piece of metal, put some gum on top of it, open the door, and once again can defeat a lot of these alarms. So the basic security measures that are in place in a lot of the field devices are not terribly hard to be able to get around, get access, and get into those facilities. Also, with many of our customers, those remote sites have alarms going off all the time, because wind can shake the door and alarm it. You can have sometimes a leaf go off and other factors. So a lot of times when those alarms go off, they ignore it. Oh, there it goes again. Yeah, we have been having trouble with that site all the time. So here's another attack vector that we found to be effective. Go to the site, trigger the alarm, and run away. Then they're going to respond, no one's there. Go 30 minutes later, trigger the alarm, run away. If you do that 4 or 5 times in a 6 or 7 hour interval, what are they going to do by the 5th time? Oh, it must be a false alarm. So then when it does open, everybody ignores it, and boom, you're able to get in the facility with minimal interruptions. So once again, if you understand human nature of how the monitoring of these sites work, once again, not terribly hard to get around or bypass. Most of the field equipment is going to have serial proprietary or USB ports for field technicians to be able to directly plug in. In many cases, the direct physical access usually bypasses or gets around any authentication measures. Why? The logic is, if you're physically able to get to the system, you must be authorized, and therefore authentication is just going to slow down the maintenance process. So almost all of these devices out there have ways that you can directly plug in, bypassing any security, getting direct access to those devices. And if they do have passwords, they're often simple default settings on the system. As I mentioned, a lot of these older devices have no local security in place. A lot of these older devices don't even have lock cases. They don't even have locks on the cases themselves. Once again, they're assuming that the fence, the video, and the lock on the building is enough protection. So if you could physically get access to those devices, opening up and getting direct access to the chipset is not terribly difficult or hard. And even the cases that do have locks, based on the size and the way these systems are designed, they're usually those little tiny, smaller locks, which you don't even need your big sledgehammer. Your little baby hammer will work fine for that. You can just knock that thing off. So even if those are there, they're pretty easy to get around. And then you could literally go in and take a system where you can actually put your control right there on the chip, and you can actually read the information right off the chipset in order to gather it. Also, when you're talking cellular, do you realize cellular devices give off a noise in which if you get close enough, you can actually intercept the cryptographic key in order to do that? So one of the attacks we do is we'll go into where the cellular communication device is and we'll shut it off and we'll turn it back on again. Why are we doing that? When you restart a communication device, what has to be loaded? The cryptographic keys, which means they have to be decrypted in memory. So if I can restart your cell device and I'm just nearby with the proper wireless sniffer, when it decrypts, I can actually pull the key instantly off of it and use that as a way to gather your information. So the new cellular technology, I don't even need to set up direct diodes onto your EEPROMs. I can literally just do it remotely by restarting the device. But you can also go in and directly connect and read the information off, or you can do bus snooping. The idea of bus snooping is, instead of going after the chip, because honestly, some of these field devices are so packed that the chips are actually behind other equipment, other components. So to get direct access to some of these chips, you have to unassemble the unit, which then starts getting very time consuming. And I'm one of those people, it used to drive my mom crazy. I love taking things apart. When I put them back together, I always have pieces left over. I'm always more efficient than the operators were at doing that. So with my customers, if I start doing authorized tests and I take things apart and I can't get them back together, it doesn't make them real happy. They're not very thrilled with me at that point. So I try to avoid having to go in and take things apart. Therefore, if I can't get to the chip, I get to the bus, which is just a communication channel between all the chips, and that's just as good for pulling the information, the data, and the details off of that chipset on that box. Then we would go in and we would look for anything with high amounts of randomness or entropy, and that's going to be indicative of the cryptographic keys. Because a good cryptographic key is random. Most communication is not random. So if I can see any changes or deviations in the entropy, I can use that to determine right where the key is, and then I can use that to be able to pull it off and try to brute force, break, or do a stream passing attack of the encrypted key to be able to decrypt or gain access to your information. So let's go in now and do our final lab, where we're going to go in and take captures of information that we've taken off bus snooping, and then you're going to analyze that information in the lab. So we're going to go in and we're going to start on page 59 for this lab. Now, one thing I want to mention in this lab, page 59 goes in and shows you basically what we're going to do. We're going to have you go in and analyze some dump files, look for some encoding, try to find where the cryptographic key is, and then do some graphing. Based on how this lab works, where we're doing a lot of command line, if you look at page 60, the actual commands that you're going to type for this lab are actually bold in the slide itself. So this lab, because it's command line, we actually set it up differently. The text explains what you're doing, but the actual commands are on the slide in bold letters. So for example, with slide 60, you're going to type cd/home/samurai/sample-file/embedded-data-dumps. Now let me help you out here. If you're not that familiar with Linux, you don't have to type each directory fully. Watch what happens here. If I go in and I type HO and I hit tab, it fills in the rest for me. So you only have to go in and type in the first few letters and keep hitting tab. It is case sensitive, so make sure you do uppercase letters here, but that's going to go in and make it a lot quicker for you to do. Just type the first few letters, hit tab, hit enter, and then you're going to go in and type xxd memdump less. Now, we're looking for the high entropy. Now, you don't have to know a lot about crypto. Watch the screen. Can you tell me where an anomaly appears on this screen? Right there. So even if you don't have a lot of detailed knowledge of crypto, you can quickly see that anomaly appearing where the data is clearly represented differently than it is during the normal information. And that's where that key is located in that file. So we're going to have you do that base analysis. Then we're going to have you use a command called strings. And that's going to go through and look at any of the ASCII characters. And once again, you can clearly see the unusual traffic popping out. When you're using the less command, you would use Q to escape out of that. So you just use Q to escape out or quit that command. Then you can also go in and we can use the entropy graph command to also go in and be able to graph out and once again be able to spot the anomaly. So you can all once again see where there's clearly an anomaly in that traffic and communication. And then the final thing we're going to have you do on page 63 is we're going to have you use a brute forcing tool called ZBGoodFind that's going to try to brute force the cryptographic key. So this way we don't even have to go in and manually do work against it. So if I go in and run that against it, after 7,077 guesses, I was able to actually break the cryptographic key in this particular case. Now we made it small so it would work for this lab. Typically it could take hours to do, but we figured having you stare at your screen for 3 hours wouldn't be a good use of time. So we sort of kept it simple. But this lab is meant to show you how if you get the raw data from the bus or the EEPROM, you can sniff, analyze, and actually be able to brute force and compromise the keys in that environment. So let's go ahead and remember the commands you're typing are actually in the slide in bold letters for this specific exercise. And then we'll go ahead and we'll give you, this lab usually goes pretty quick, so I'll give you 10 minutes. We'll start back at 10 after 5, and then we have about 8 slides left to finish up, and we should get you out of here just before 5:30. So we're actually tracking perfectly on our end time of 5:30 today. So let's go ahead, work on this lab for about 10 minutes, get an idea to see how to do that, and then we'll jump back and finish up the final lecture. All right, so let's go ahead and finish up not only this section, but finish up today's material by looking at how these firmware attacks can actually be used as a spreading mechanism to cause a lot of damage in a big area. So one area where we often focus a lot on firmware level attacks is smart meters. The idea is when you're monitoring the electricity utilization, typically in a residential area, instead of having physical meters where a person has to come and read the meter on a weekly or monthly basis, you actually have a smart meter that can, via wireless, be able to communicate everything back to the main processing facility. Well, the way they set up is a neighborhood is a mesh wireless. Each house communicates to the next house, communicates to the next house. So now you can have shortwave wireless to get all the way back to the main control center to accurately gather all the data for all of the units that are out there. So as many of you know, one of the big security conferences that's run around the world, the big one is in Vegas, Black Hat, but there's also Black Hat Asia, Black Hat Europe, Black Hat Australia, where they focus a lot on the new up-and-coming attack vectors. In 2009, you had Mike Davis demonstrate a proof-of-concept code where if you were able to infect one piece of firmware in one smart meter with malicious code, that it could actually go in and be able to spread to every other smart meter in that mesh configuration. Now, think about this. If I could go to one house, or if it was my house, and I could just infect one smart meter with one piece of code that wasn't very hard to write, it could propagate across a neighborhood of 3,000 to 5,000 houses and get them all infected with that same type of malware. And that malware could do anything to falsely report utilization, to actually misrepresent billing information, or cause all sorts of havoc for that utility that was trying to monitor that information. Now, obviously, he only tested this in a lab environment, because going into a real neighborhood and infecting 5,000 smart meters probably wouldn't be the best thing to do, and probably wouldn't be the most legal thing to do either. But the point is, he was able to show with enough validation in a lab environment that this was actually feasible. And these are the styles of attacks that we have to recognize and deal with over time, because there's so much dependency and interconnectivity between these field devices that if you can go in and be able to infect one field device and it can then upload back to the HMI and infect that HMI, that HMI can then become a centralized area to infect all the other sensors. So similar to the Mike Davis model, where he was using a mesh-based network, where one smart meter infected the next smart meter, infected the next smart meter, if we alter that configuration, what if we were able to get to one field device, infect it, and it can infect the HMI? Then the 20 or 30,000 field devices that are all monitored and controlled by that one HMI, it can then push down the infected code and once again be able to spread very quickly and very fast in those environments. So those are some of the issues and challenges that we face when we're talking about attacking these end devices, is they could lead to very fast, very quick propagation by either compromising the device, the communication, or the HMI component that's communicating that system. So we've now looked at physical ways that if you get access to a field device, you could potentially cause large amounts of harm in that environment. So today, we hopefully raised your awareness of a lot of the different attack vectors, ways that servers, network, field devices, wireless, and other protocols could be attacked and compromised by the adversary. Now, once we have that knowledge and we have a really good idea of the vulnerabilities and exposures, tomorrow we're going to talk about defensive measures from a server perspective. And Saturday, we're going to talk about defensive measures from a communication and networking perspective. So today was our offense day to understand the exposures. And then day 3 and day 4 are going to be our defensive days of how to protect, secure, and release mitigating measures within our environment. So at this point, as we wrap up day 2, are there any questions or comments or concerns on anything we've covered? Excellent. Then with that, we are going to officially end class for today. Otherwise, have a wonderful evening. I will see you at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. You will need book 3. You will need the lab book, and you will need your laptop for tomorrow's class. Have a wonderful evening, and we'll see you at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Once again, thanks for an awesome day.